We're back on Canuck Central. It's Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah here on a Monday. And the weather is looking good. Canucks are going to be back home later this week. Sun is shining here in January. Maybe the second half of the season will be stronger than the first half was for Vancouver. They kicked it off with a 3-0 win over the Maple Leafs on Saturday in Winnipeg tomorrow. Let's bring in our next guest. It is Frank Saravalli. He is a presentation of Angry Otter Liquor. Thanks for this, Frank. I think it's pretty obvious. One win can change a lot. Certainly a lot of vibes around the Canucks feel better after beating the Leafs on Saturday.
Yeah, no kidding. And also the way in which they did it, the delayed travel, it kind of, you know, it's one game and try not to overthink it or overreact, but feels like it was a step forward for the character of this team, which has been in question for a while.
Well, and especially considering it was in Toronto where, you know, a lot of rumors starting to begin to, a lot of speculation happens. And if had they lost that game, the narrative would have been a lot different too. And for a team that's, you know, maybe teetering a little bit and has had some confidence issues, getting a game like this narrative-wise even, they seem to take on bigger importance.
It does, and look, I think there's been so much made about everything from rumor to innuendo to hearsay that for me, so much of this season can be boiled down into a way more simple form. And it all comes down to health. The healthier this team is now, getting Phil Aronic back, it just changes the, you know, the complexion, the view of this group, and they have a chance to make a statement about themselves and put a lot of that to bed.
Do you think the people around the league view Quinn Hughes as a Hart Trophy candidate at the midway point?
I think he's in the conversation for sure. I don't know that he's the favorite, but I think people fully recognize how difficult this Canucks season has been, how excellent his play has been from start to finish and consistent, and really how special this, you know, this last, I don't know, 18 months has been for Quinn Hughes. He would certainly be in my top three. I have to, you know, I actually need to submit a midseason awards ballot for something we're doing at Daily Faceoff later tonight. So I have to determine exactly where he fits in that three, but certainly deserving of consideration and in the conversation for sure.
And, you know, the other Canucks defenseman who's returning, it looks like, is Filip Hronek. And we talked so much about how the Canucks are in a really tough spot leverage-wise because of their injuries and the clear need they have. Does it change when you get a player back healthy and all of a sudden that need isn't quite as acute? Can that help in their leverage in trade talks as they continue to look for a defenseman?
Not really. Only Sat because this was a need before Phil Aronic went out and before Quinn Hughes was banged up. So you can't BS the rest of the league. Everyone has an idea of what you were after to begin with. And that's in an odd way, that's kind of the beauty of what the Canucks are after, because that need exists to me really irrespective of where they are in the standings, whether they're 10 points up on a playoff spot or 10 points back, this team still needs to add a significant impact defenseman that can help more efficiently transport the puck and get it out of their own end. Until that's solved for, you know, I think you have to keep everything else in mind with whatever else they might be looking for.
Yeah, and it's it ties into the Hughes Hart Trophy conversation because, I mean, just a simple check of like what their numbers are with Hughes on the ice and without him on the ice. Like, we keep talking about the Canucks' inability to generate offense. It's because unless Quinn Hughes is on the ice, they can't transition the puck from defense to offense. It's like it's next to impossible for this team. And so for as much as, yeah, they could use a
partner out, then take his partner off the ice.
Yeah, exactly. And
then look at the skid in the standings and then say, oh, well, this Canucks team doesn't have it. They need to change things. They need to trade one of these two star centers that they have. Oh my God, our world's falling. That's why, I mean, I don't mean to you know, get away from the narrative because it's been so sexy and that's all anyone wants to talk about, but their inconsistencies to me are rooted directly in their health.
Yeah, and that changes big time when they get Hronek back, and as long as Hughes keeps playing like this, I mean, they're going to stay at least in the playoff bubble. But maybe the biggest thing that came out of Saturday was Pedersen's performance. I know he didn't light up the score sheet necessarily, Frank, but for anybody that's watched the Canucks regularly, you'd know that that was one of Pedersen's stronger games, especially on the defensive side of the puck. And I'm sure Rick Tocchet is hoping like he's going to get that version of Elias Pedersen a lot more in the second half.
Yeah, I think two C words stand out for me. Confidence is one. Compete is another. And then the other part, too, is just attention to detail, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when he strings all three of those things together, he's such an incredibly dangerous player. And that is exactly why when we have this conversation about, hey, which one stays and which one goes, if it ever got to that point, it makes it a really difficult conversation to solve for. And that's why, again, I think it's in everyone's best interest to take a step back and a deep breath and see if you can figure this thing out and have cooler heads prevail.
Yeah, and ultimately, we talked about this before. You know, I think both of us would be surprised if we see a Pedersen trade here in the season. We'll see what happens off season wise, and even a JT Miller one. But you know, this is what happens, Frank. Anytime you mention anything about the Canucks, and people listen to you on various podcasts and DFO podcast, and you mention that, hey, if I was trying to play matchmaker, maybe I'm thinking about Boston and JT Miller. You know, when it comes to JT, again, it's probably unlikely, but could there be enough interest that somebody makes an interesting offer to Vancouver between now and the trade deadline?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't put that out of the realm of possibility at all, but the idea of, just for full context for people listening, and I love how some quotes from different discussions or appearances or podcasts get tweeted without any context at all. The idea was, if you were Boston and you're looking for a number one center, which obviously they thought they were getting in Elias Lindholm, and I mean, a lot of people in Vancouver could have told them that that wouldn't be the case, that he's a solid number two. But after that, especially with the way that his skating and speed has really taken a hit, he's not it. And Pavel Zacha, as fine of a player as he is, like, neither one of those guys are legit number one on a cup contending roster. That's not how it works. And so the context was, if you're Boston, who would you be looking at? Like, who would be one high end center that you'd want to get your hands on? And I said, for me, that guy would be JT Miller, because of a lot of the things that we've talked about with Miller's game, the compete, the intensity. I think he'd fit in really well with the style of that team and their persona and the nature of what they want to accomplish. I think they're a really driven team when they're on it. That said, I can't really look at, and this is the other part of the discussion that obviously lacks context when placed in the social media sphere, is I can't really look at Boston's roster. And given the Canucks where they're at and what they'd like to accomplish, it's difficult for me to find a true trade fit as a trade partner. You know, perhaps, okay, like, let's say one of their defensemen that has some term really excites you. Who is it? And then how do you find equal value with a guy who's touched 100 points a couple years now and is knocking on the realm of the top, or in the realm of the top 15 to 20 forwards in the game? I can't find that equal value. Can you?
No, it's and you know, it's, if the Canucks were to move one of these guys, and let's say it is Miller, like, you got to get a center back in that deal, because now you got a gaping hole. Like, Pugh Suter's not going to be your second line center if you're planning on going into a playoff run. Pugh Suter's been a great find for the Canucks over the last year and a bit, but, like, you know, let's be serious about it.
Let's have proper expectations set.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're moving a player like that, you've got to be able to get something back in return. And unless there's, I know your favorite term, a hockey trade out there, and it works out for all parties, which is very rare to happen in season, I don't see how moving either of Pedersen or Miller really works for the Canucks in that context.
I mean, I don't either, but, like, far be it for me to inject some logic into this conversation. That's just, I feel like all we've done here is spitball things that just, I mean, they seemingly aren't rooted in reality.
Well, we're biding time until the Canucks find a defenseman that's worthy of acquiring at a price that makes sense.
This is the other thing we talked about last week, though. Like, let's go through the league. I've yet to find one that is on a team that they would actually consider moving that piece.
Right. I mean, I wonder, you know, the thing I've been wondering about too is because there are so few players or defensemen that have control or are controlled with term or RFA years that are truly available that kind of fit that bill. Could it be a player, let's say, for instance, right now Columbus doesn't want to move Provorov, but let's say they get to a point where they want to move Provorov. Would he be a player that could maybe fit what they're looking for and they'd be willing to maybe work out an extension? And then because they can work out an extension, that would allow them to move the bigger piece to make someone like that happen.
Well, okay, so let's take a step back now and let's talk about what Don Waddell has previously acknowledged, right? Which is they'd like to retain him and extend him if possible.
Right.
And it's rare for players that have expressed interest in staying. There's a whole number of different reasons why he's interested. One, there's been an explosion of Russian talent on that team and Marchenko and some of the other guys that have really popped off. And two, his younger brother is committed to Ohio State and will be in Columbus next year, so there's a family factor. I mean, if you're Columbus, you're looking at this year and you're going, okay, we're in the mix this season that no one really expected. We owe it to our players and our fan base to reward them for the year that we've had, even though we might not get in. We can't just begin selling off pieces. That sends the wrong message. And that's why I had an article post today. I went through all 16 teams in the East and looked at their objectives for the trade deadline. Outside of the New York Islanders, there is not one team that I can put firmly in the seller category. I can list for you a whole host of reasons why they should either stay put and just kind of enjoy this ride that they're on, or think long view and long term about what they've got going on, that it's not a traditional sell-off in the way that so many people look at the deadline, which is trade roster player in exchange for future assets. It's a really unique deadline to this point that, you know, even by normal mushy standing standards, that this year looks and feels totally different than others.
Yeah, I mean, there's teams that have been rebuilding forever, so they may not want to be hardcore sellers or want to try and stay in the race as long as they possibly can. So maybe they decide not to sell heavily come deadline time. And even the few sellers, you know, is there a lot to pick off of those teams considering Chicago and San Jose have already been selling the last couple of years?
Well, and then so add in another team like St. Louis, that they've committed a lot to trying to get in the playoffs this year. They've already traded for Cam Fowler. They made their coaching change. Like, pick whoever it is that you want to look at, and then tell me where the real assets of value are. Okay, so this was another thing mentioned on my pod today. Okay, so why couldn't the St. Louis Blues flip Cam Fowler? Well, he's still got the same contract last time I checked that limited the Anaheim Ducks in terms of places that he'd want to go to. I don't think they're going to go through that entire process and then turn around and say, hey, we want to move you again. And not only that, but they only got a second-round pick in return as it was. I mean, what exactly do they think they're going to get this time around? It's difficult. I say all that just to say it's difficult to find who that blue line fit is going to be for the Canucks, because I just, even on the list of longer range possibilities, the long shots, I think it's difficult.
Yeah, and I know we, you know, the deadline is when most deals happen anyways, but even this year, it kind of seems like we have to wait even closer to the deadline. There's only one team in the East that's really out of it, and they're not even that far out, is the Buffalo Sabres. Everybody else is at least within 5 points of a wild card spot, and the Western Conference isn't quite the same, but, you know, a team like Utah, St. Louis, and obviously Calgary, they can fancy themselves being in the playoff race. And does this kind of just mean there's only a handful of teams right now open for business, and those teams probably have some, you know, slim assets? Like, the only team I look at is really Seattle, but, you know, what has to give before they make big trades? Do they make a decision on Ron Francis? Are they going to let Ron Francis do the sell-off there? Like, what's going to happen with Seattle?
Yeah, I think it's a fair question to ask. And to go back to the East for a second, I'm still not ready and willing to declare the Sabres dead. And you might say, oh, well, they've got 10 points and all these teams to jump over. How could they possibly do it? 2 weeks ago, the Detroit Red Wings were right there with you.
Yeah,
they've won 7 in a row, and they're now firmly in the playoff mix. And if you go by points percentage, you're only out by a hair. So you've got the Wings there. You've got the Montreal Canadiens, who a few weeks ago were the team that was below the Buffalo Sabres in the standings. They've been on a hot run. The moral of the story in the East is you have 2 good weeks, and you're right in it. So to think that this Sabres team or the Rangers or some of these other teams that are right there can't possibly be a playoff team this year, I don't think it's safe to declare anything about the bottom of the Eastern Conference, only that I think there's 6 playoff spots that are stone-cold mortal locks and 7 in the West. And when it comes to Seattle, by the way, one thing I wanted to mention with some of those teams in the East, and frankly, a lot of the teams in the West, they're open for business, but they don't want futures back. Mm. They want roster players back that can fix their team or help their team right now because they're unhappy with the spot that they're in. And also, this is an interesting year to watch with first round picks, because there are a lot of teams that aren't real wild about it and don't get excited by late first round picks this year because of the nature of this year's scouting crop.
Well, how much are teams like or the league looking at the situations like Buffalo and Detroit and even Ottawa to a certain extent and being like, do we want to just like be in this rebuilding mode forever? It feels like there's not that draft picks are being devalued, but it does feel like there's a shift in how teams are valuing what they want to acquire and trade.
Well, I think there was this notion over the last couple of weeks, and I don't really know where the conversation started, so I couldn't pinpoint it, but there was this thought process of, hey, look, rebuilds don't work. Look at what the Sabres are going through. Look how long it's been for the Sens, the Red Wings. The Anaheim Ducks have been at this for a little while. The Sharks are kind of just in the thick of it. Oh, what about the Blackhawks? Yeah. And I look at all those teams, and with all due respect, I'd much rather be them than the St. Louis Blues.
Yep.
I just don't know what, as well as the Blues have drafted in mid to late first round picks, like their track record is almost impeccable if you go through it year by year. And Jake Neighbors is the latest example. How do you mine a 30-goal scorer in the late first round? Like, they've been doing it with consistency. Their average draft position, I think, over Doug Armstrong's tenure is 36th overall, because they've traded a bunch of picks too. So as impressive as that has been, I don't know how the Blues go from 10th to 12th place in their conference to 5th. They have no future stars in their pipeline. They have no future stars on their roster. They've got a couple nice pieces, but what's their ammo and what are their assets to get there? I'd rather sell the hope, as difficult as that might sound in terms of a plea, but I'd rather look at, if you're Chicago, and say, well, we've got Vlasic on the blue line now. Sam Ranzel is a surefire, bona fide top pair NHL defenseman. And we've got Artem Levchunov, number 2 overall pick. Those 3 guys are the future of our back end, and we're going to bet on that. And it might take us 3 or 4 years to get there, but with Connor Bedard up front, that's a way better path to competing for something meaningful rather than just telling people, hey, well, we're in the mix.
Yeah.
In the mix doesn't mean anything to me. But that's just me.
Or even Nashville, and you pull the plug on your rebuild plan or retool plan a little early, and now you're in a much worse spot after the spending spree they went on in free agency this year.
It's I mean, I don't even want to talk about Nashville. It gives me anxiety thinking about what Barry Trotz has in front of him.
Frank, we appreciate the time as always. Thanks so much for this today.
See you guys. Have a good week.
Now, there is the great Frank Saravalli joining us here on Canucks Central. I wouldn't say that he got radioed with some of his matchmaking with JT Miller and Boston, but certainly was more of a hypothesis than anything else. Frank on Sports at 650 was brought to you by Angry Otter Liquor. It's Dan Riccio and Satyar Shah. And this is the name of the game. Like, you know, I go out and I have beer league hockey once a week, and the Moose are always looking for updates on what the Canucks are looking for in the trade market, and wondering if Pedersen or Miller is going to get traded. And
do they hate each other?
Yeah. How much do they hate each other? What was the big beef in the room that caused all this? All these questions that really the answers aren't as salacious as you might think. But also, the hard thing to answer about, like, well, where are the Canucks getting a defenseman from is like, I don't know. You tell me.
Well, I mean,
because there's no defenseman available.
I mean,
no good ones, at least no real good ones.
If people knew how much time we spent, and maybe I should say myself, I spend looking over other teams' rosters, looking for something I've missed.
Yeah.
It's pretty ridiculous. Like, I've spent hours upon hours poring over teams, their systems, players, and trying to figure out, okay, who can be available, calling people, trying to figure out, okay, where is this guy at with the team? And anybody that's of any consequence, you know what you hear when you ask around? They like this guy.
Yeah.
Because getting defensemen who can move the puck and are reliable, they've become maybe the scarcest asset. Like, you talk about right-hand defensemen, they're, you know, maybe the most scarce high-end asset is a top four, legitimate top four right-hand defenseman, right? But even legitimate puck-moving defenseman is not that far off, especially a guy who's even decent defensively.
Yeah.
It's very hard finding these guys. And that's why, you know, I brought Provorov up and him as an example that if you can't find a guy under control, would you be willing to trade for a guy that you can extend?
Mm-hmm.
Now, even those guys, the list isn't very long. Like, it's Provorov, it's Gavrikov, and now we're hearing both guys are going to stay at their destinations most likely. So take two guys off the list. And people bring up Mike Matheson, but Mike Matheson is their best. Lane Hudson is the future of their defense. Mike Matheson is the guy who plays 25 minutes a game and carries that blue line.
Yeah.
What do you think the cost is going to be to trade Mike Matheson, who has one more year left on his contract after this?
Quite a bit.
And given everything we just said, the Habs are now competing for a playoff spot.
They're 2 points out.
I think it's more likely they extend Mike Matheson than trade Mike Matheson next year. But that's the way I see him, especially with how hard it is to find these defensemen. Like, it's become...
Well, even Adam Larson, right?
Yeah, like, that's why Seattle, you know, I'm kind of wondering... And the worst case scenario for teams that are looking to add a defenseman would be for Seattle to hold on and make decisions this offseason. But I'm not sure Ron Francis is allowed, and he's too conservative in nature anyways, I think, to go out and trade some of his top guys.
Yeah.
Especially in season.
You know, you think about, and I know Elliot said this on 32 Thoughts the other day, but there's teams around the league wondering, should they have been the one that made the trade for Alex Carrier? Because, and we had this discussion at the time, it's like, yeah, you may not be absolutely in love with this player, but what else is going to be out there and available for you? And that ultimately becomes the question for a team like the Vancouver Canucks, a team like the Dallas Stars, who are going to be looking for a defenseman, much like they did when they acquired Chris Tanev last year. There's a lot of teams looking for blue line help, and not a ton of blue line help readily available amongst the sellers in the National Hockey League. Stan Riccio, Satyar Shah, Don Taylor is going to join us next on Canuck Central.
Hey, it's Jamie Dodd
and Thomas Drantz.
Get your daily dose of Canucks talk with us weekdays from 12 to 2 on Sportsnet 650.
Or catch up on demand through your favorite podcast app.
Hour number two, Canucks Central, Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah here in the Kintec studio. Canucks in the peg I'll take on the Winnipeg Jets tomorrow. Still feeling the glow of a win over the Maple Leafs in the Big Smoke Saturday night, hockey night in Canada. 3-0 winners. Everybody feeling a little bit better about the Canucks after that one. Let's bring in our next guest. It is Don Taylor. Donnie and Dolly, 10 to noon on Czech TV. And a regular here on Canuck Central every single Monday. It's just it's a way different vibe after the Canucks beat the Maple Leafs on Saturday night. Hey, Donnie.
Hold on, guys. I'm just having some phone issues. Give me 1 second.
Okay. Donnie is having some phone issues.
There we go. We got Donnie back.
Old man phone issues here. I apologize. all good.
Never happened before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you wait till you get old. You'll have a lot of them. You guys are also good at that stuff. The vibe around the team. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one thing to win a game, another thing to win on the road, although I guess Canuck fans should be used to that. And it's another one to play an impressive game. You know, one of their best performances of the season. There haven't been a lot, but in Toronto, that makes it a big deal and a bigger deal. And especially when the hometown fans in Toronto are booing the Leafs, makes it extra special. But it was good. It was, and I don't know how you guys felt, but after a disappointing Saturday of NFL playoff action, the hockey was really good. Like, I didn't expect that. I thought the NFL would kick ass. It wasn't the case, certainly on Saturday.
Yeah.
And then that Canuck game, from a Canuck point of view, was really good. Then you had the Kings and Flames and Habs and Stars that were really good as well on Hockey Night in Canada. So it was an entertaining night for a lot of people, hockey-wise.
Yeah, it was, right? And you're right about the football. We don't need to do the football thing, but I thought the only really good game was the Commanders-Tampa Bay game, which was the last game last night. But that's a different conversation for a different time, I suppose.
It's just so typical NFL, isn't
yeah.
it? That's the game you remember, right? You know, it's like you go to a game sometimes, any sport, and the last 5 minutes is good. The rest was a dog. You'll say, that was a great game.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the way it was for the NFL this weekend. So much anticipation. It's the NFL. It's always good. Don't get me wrong. But relatively speaking, it was a bit of a disappointing weekend. But that last game, especially with the doink game winner, was something special for Washington, especially.
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, as far as the Canucks, and that was an entertaining hockey game, right? Yep. Like, it wasn't the most high event back and forth game, but, you know, beating the Leafs and the intensity of it, I think, was good. And, you know, the big storyline, obviously, was Elias Pettersson's performance. And we all know one game doesn't mean a player is back, but was that a type of statement performance we've been waiting for, at least to some extent, from Pettersson?
It was really noticeable defensively, and oftentimes it's hard to do for a forward, and obviously his teammates were chanting Selke on the bench. They noticed as well. I think, guys, I don't know if you remember, but I believe it was, I want to say early first or mid first. This wasn't defensively, it was offensively. He made a move coming out of the right corner on a Leafs defenseman, and it looked like the old Elias Pettersson. He got a shot away. And it was something that we haven't seen for a long time, where he beat a man, his feet were moving, which Rick Tocchet talks a lot about. And I just wonder if that set the tone for him, because it was a really impressive move. Didn't get a lot of attention, but I thought that might have set the tone for him. And then he was blocking shots and coming up with giveaways and hustling back on D, like he always has when he's at his best. So that was really, 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 really impressive, and something that, you know, might signal some better times ahead for the Canucks.
Yeah, you would hope so. It's the kind of performance that reminds you why you shouldn't go too far down the road of exploring trades for a player like this, because, I mean, these guys are hard to find. These are the guys you kind of, at least, you know, what Pettersson had been prior to this almost year-long slump he's been on now. Yeah. You know, these are the kind of guys you tank for, right? You go to the top end of the first round of the draft so that you can acquire a player like this. When you have them, you can't let them go, and certainly not after you've signed them to a mega extension like the Canucks have with Pettersson.
And I don't think, guys, and I've said this a lot, and I know Drance will disagree with me, but I've never been I like the player. I don't like the contract. I don't know if I ever will. You know, top five contract in the NHL, I'm not sure. But he's had moments where, you know, you look at him and you say, there's a guy that could do something special in the league. And certainly that was the case on Saturday. it's been a long time coming. And you think about it, he had the break. So, you know, the Carolina game, you know, which was so uneventful, he kind of eased in there. But he looked, maybe that break did him good. And he looked really, really good on Saturday, confident and just having impact on both ends of the ice, certainly in the defensive end of the ice.
Well, the other big story in the game, and you know, outside of the Canucks winning, was Quinn Hughes' performance yet again, and this time in the center of the universe, which always attracts even more attention, yeah. Obviously, right? But is there anything else to be said that we can say about Quinn that we haven't said already?
Gosh, I don't know. I'll say this. This means nothing to anybody except us. I thought his interview today was really good. So how about that?
Yeah, that's not good. Yeah, it's good. It's
good. Post-practice. It's the first really good interview he's had in a while. You know, as the season drags on and he gets so many requests. But his interview today, especially when he lightened up talking about Hronek, was really, really good. And, you know, that's something that a young player as a captain has to grow into and with so many interview requests. I just don't know what else you can say. And I think one thing that doesn't get a lot of attention with Quinn Hughes because he's so effortless is his skating. Not his skating, but his speed. And we all know about how he can maneuver, but just his ability to catch up to people. And I can't, guys, you can help me out. What game was it? Was it the Carolina game? I can't remember, where he was caught deep in the offensive zone and he had to hustle back and he caught up and intercepted a pass on what would have been a 2-on-1. And that was just something that we don't really talk a lot about. That he is really, really fast. It's just that much like, and I hate throwing this name out there because people are going to criticize me. It's much like Bobby Orr, and that Bobby Orr was so, and I'm old enough to remember his ability to maneuver is what you notice more than anything, and his stick skills and his shot and everything. But you almost forgot that he was also way faster than everybody too. And I think that's the case with Quinn Hughes as well. So maybe that's something that I think people don't talk enough about.
He's kind of transcended, not just superstar, but you know, he's on the short list of the best five players in the league. You know, even when Canucks in the past have won Hart trophies, it's like, yeah, they were the best player in the league that year, but they weren't considered the best player in the league. And look, it's a high bar to get to the Connor McDavids of the world and stuff like that. But I don't know. Quinn Hughes feels like he's kind of in that stratosphere right now because the Canucks are nowhere near even sniffing a playoff spot without him in the lineup right now.
Oh, my gosh. I can't imagine where they'd be. And here's another thing we can say is that he's been pretty durable.
Yeah.
You know, very durable, considering how much punishment he takes. You know, if you want to go all the way back to the Nashville series last year, I mean, he takes punishment. He saw the shot to the face and other situations this year, you know, the hand injury, missing games there. But relatively speaking, given how much of a target he is and how much he has the puck, I think his durability is something that you can't put in question. I mean, he's just so special. And I know I say this a lot, but just enjoy him while you can, folks. And, you know, I think myself as a fan, I think I soaked in Pavel Bure enough, although you would have liked him to stay longer. But it's the same thing with Quinn Hughes. Enjoy him while you can. Just such a special player. And, you know, like whether he ends up staying in Vancouver his whole career or not, I guarantee it'll go by very, very quickly. So enjoy him while you can.
Yeah, I think you just took the words out of my mouth. It always goes by a lot faster than you expect. Before you know it, 20 years has passed and a career is over. It's pretty mind-boggling thinking back to it. But don't need to reminisce about that too much. But, you know, as far as looking ahead to the Canucks, and, you know, from our perspective, right, the media's perspective, the narratives were too good to pass up after the win against Toronto, right? And we're always looking for the proverbial turning point. And story-wise, it can't be better than unexpected win in Toronto to turn your season around, right? And this was the moment where the Canucks, you know, launched off and became the team we all kind of hoped they would be, and the rest is history. We all hope for that to be the case, but sometimes reality has a different plan than what our narratives want us to believe. But Filip Hronek is looking to be back soon. If not tomorrow, he'll be back playing on Thursday, it looks like. Could this finally be what we've been waiting for, the Canucks being as healthy as possible? You know, I know Joshua is out, but as healthy as you can expect to be in the NHL, and that we finally see that this true team and maybe what they can truly be for us?
Yeah, well, if that core six can get together and go on some sort of run, I mean, or at least attempt to go on some sort of run, I think that gives the Canucks a pretty good shot. Now, is Demko in that core six? I think he is, although Lankinen's been absolutely fabulous. But just if you get a chance, folks, take a look at the interview on Twitter or Canucks.com and just the look on Quinn Hughes' face when he talks about Hronek being back. I think, you know, it says it all. It's a little thing, but I think it says a lot and just speaks to the importance of Philip Hronek, whether you would think he's going to come back as Hughes' partner, or will he continue with Myers, or not sure, somebody else on the right side? Will Hronek drive his own pair? I'm not sure, but just the look on his face, just, you know, this is a very, very good hockey player in Quinn Hughes, and he almost looked like a kid. He just thought like a fan when he was talking about Hronek today. So that, I think, it speaks to the importance of Philip Hronek. Is he perfect? Is he Bobby Orr? No, but man, he's going to help on that right side a whole lot.
I'm not the one making the coaching decisions, but I kind of feel like Hughes and Myers have played well enough together that I want to try Hronek on a different pair, considering like how bad the Canucks minutes are when Hughes isn't on the ice. They've got to try and find something that, you know, elevates the team to those minutes when Quinn isn't on the ice. And if you put Quinn and Philip Hronek back together right away, you miss any chance of possibly doing that.
Yeah, and Myers actually had more minutes the other night in Toronto than Hughes, if I'm not mistaken. And look, this has not been a great season. Saturday aside, it's not been a great season, and much of the season has been with Hronek and Hughes together. I think, given how Myers has played there, you know, solid as can be, in my opinion, I think you've got to give it a shot. You know, because I'm not so sure it was working before. The two great players. I'm not so sure it was working like it has in the past. You can always go back to it. I think it's worth trying at the very least.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think at least for the time being, spread it around a little bit and see how it goes. You can always bring it back situationally. You're chasing in the game, bring it up. And I know Quinn was very adamant. We spoke to him in training camp, and we brought up the idea of splitting them up, and he was very much like hard no to the idea. And then he got diplomatic about it, but essentially said, don't break what's not broken. But I think what we've seen so far is probably an easier sell to Quinn now, too, that, hey, as much as you guys want to play together, it might be for the greater good to split them up.
Yeah, I mean, whoever he's played with, I mean, let's you know, most recently Myers. I mean, Quinn Hughes is so dominant. Mm-hmm. As long as that guy is somewhat of a rock back there, somewhat solid back there, his partner I'm talking about, Myers or not, you kind of don't notice him all that much, which is a good thing because Hughes is out there. He has the puck a lot. He's doing things offensively and defensively. As long as that player can stay the course, be solid, not make mistakes, I think that could very well be the way to go. And, you know, you're paying Hronek enough money that he should be able to drive. You would think you'd be able to drive his own pairing. And I just think, given what's happened earlier in the season, like, forget about last season. It's gone. You know, yeah, it worked. But this season, you know, the season hasn't been great, even with that pairing together. So maybe you try something else. And like you just said, Sat, and I said before that, you can always go back to it depending on game situation.
So, I mean, hey, sometimes the Jack Adams Award can be a bit of a curse for coaches we've seen through history. And not that I think Rick Tocchet is anywhere near a hot seat or anything like that, but it certainly feels like from a fan base perspective, gauging how they feel, the shine is starting to wear off on the head coach of the Vancouver Canucks, and more of the, hey, what's with this low event hockey? Canucks are having another snooze fest here. Do you feel like the shine is wearing off Rick Tocchet and how he's coached up these Canucks?
Not for me, but yes, in terms of the public and the fan base, and certainly social media, and it's a fickle fan base, and you know, it's a situation of what have you done for me lately in the entire world of sports, no matter where you are. He's got that Adams Award. If you look at the history of the recent history of the Adams Award, it's almost more of a curse than it is something to be proud of.
Yeah.
But I also look at this road trip, and I thought they played well in Montreal. I thought they played well in Washington. They were unlucky in Montreal. A couple of bad goals there. Washington, they stayed with a very good-looking hockey club. Really strong, big, scary-looking hockey club that could probably do a lot of things in the spring. Carolina was a bit of a dud. Boy, that was low event if there ever was a low event game. But, you know, maybe winnable, although it just didn't look dangerous. And then you had Toronto under some really tough circumstances given the travel. But, you know, low event hockey is usually, you know, it's a situation where the coach is doing a whole lot of coaching. And, the players are, the coach is demanding something and the players are trying to deliver it. So I think the way they've played lately speaks to Rick Tocchet, that he's demanding more out of them. And I'm in the minority, I realize, just, you know, one win on this road trip. But I kind of like the way they're playing lately, even though the results don't show it. And I think it's them coming around or coming back around to what Rick Tocchet wants.
Yeah, I completely agree with you with their overall game. I mean, that's why the Carolina game was disappointing, because they had strung together so many good performances. And then all of a sudden here came one that wasn't quite as up to par as you wanted it to be. But it just made me think about something with this market, because Berkey famously said, you can't be a boring team here. If you want to win, you have to be exciting and you have to win while being exciting. And in fairness to Tocchet, and he spoke about this today, he wants this team to be better offensively. He wants them to be better off the rush. It's not like they want to be this boring hockey team, but is it acceptable in this market to be boring and good?
I don't want to disagree with Burke, because, I mean, I'll get a phone call or something. It'll go on for 24 hours and ear will burn. Yeah. So remove my ear afterwards. I think people just want, look, 50 plus years. Mm-hmm. I honestly, let's go back to little Donnie, the Canuck fan. I didn't want to see them win. I really don't care.
Yeah.
I think most people feel the same. If it means you got to buckle down and play low event hockey, whatever, that's fine. We've seen it before. You know, when, you know, Luongo's first year or two here, that was just fine. People were okay with it. I don't know. I mean, in 1982, nothing happened with Roger Nielsen. He loved it. You know, what happened in that game, Roger? Nothing. I loved it. I think the people who know hockey well would be totally accepting of it, as long as you got the W's.
I kind of feel like the Canucks are ahead of the game, kind of workshopping this theory a little bit of like where the NHL is headed, and it's part and parcel with like analytics and how they are shaping the game. We saw it in baseball and how much numbers have changed the game to a point where Rob Manfred had to make a bunch of rule changes, right? Because everything was just like it was a home run, it was a strikeout, there was hardly
basketball
any balls.
Next. Yeah.
Basketball now with the three-pointer, and I feel like the Canucks are ahead of the game as far as where hockey is going and how the numbers are affecting the way the game is played. It's quality over quantity. And you look at these three games, they've played against Washington, where they actually had a few shots on net. Carolina had under 20 shots. The Leafs had 20, I think, on the night, the other night. Both teams were under 20 in that game between the Canucks and Toronto. And it's not that they don't want to get offense, but you know, both teams are saying we want quality over quantity, and also we don't want to take too many chances that are going to leave us vulnerable going back the other way off the rush. So you're going to start seeing more and more games in the league, Donnie, where they are going to be classified as low event. The hope is like there's more big events, even in the low event atmosphere. I feel like volume shooting is not in vogue anymore in the National Hockey League.
Well, Dan, you said we're going to see more. I think we're already. I stand to be corrected here, which happens a lot. But I think we've already seen that, not just with Canuck games, but around the league. Just noticing what happened on the weekend.
Yeah.
And again, I could be wrong here, but I just seem to notice a lot of games where there's not a lot of shots, maybe quality shots, but not a lot of volume. And hey, what's just around the corner? The playoffs. And that's kind of the, well, it's not kind of, it is the way you have to play. So it's not really surprising. And Quinn Hughes talked about that today in his interview about how, you know, this is, you know, teams are a couple of months away from the playoffs. It's time to lock it down and get really, really serious. So that's not surprising at all.
Are you watching your Vikings tonight, or?
Of course, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a good uniform battle today, a couple of old school teams, so I'm looking forward to that, and just really interested, I think like everybody else, what Sam Darnold can do at the Minnesota Vikings. Can that possibly continue? It's it's interesting for a lot of reasons. I hope it's better than what we saw on the weekend, other than the Washington game.
Yeah, maybe just a close game would be nice. Donnie, you're the best. Thanks for this.
No problem, guys. Anytime. Lots of fun.
There he is, the great, the legend, Don Taylor, joining us here on Canucks Central, as he does every single Monday. It is interesting the way that the game is going, and maybe the Canucks are on the extreme end of it, but the way Rick Tocchet coaches his club to play hockey, and he said it today, it's not that I don't want offense, but essentially when we try to generate offense, it's also with the mind of like, yeah, we can generate offense, but it can't come at the cost of what we're doing on the defensive side of the puck, because ultimately we need that to fuel our offense. We're going to develop everything off of what we do defensively and off the puck.
And come playoff time, that's the way you have success. And Woodley pointed this out, when you break down how the Canucks were playing last season from how they generated chances, but also how few rush chances they had, but how they forechecked a team that was very similar to them, Florida Panthers last year. So not
I think
so
they had success last year. Yeah,
yeah, very successful, right? So, and it's, I think those teams, they do a better job in transition than the Canucks this year. Yeah. So there are things they have to improve. But as far as philosophy-wise, I have no issues with the philosophy. I would like to see some tweaks to how they break out from time to time. Like, I do think sometimes they are a bit too basic, but how much of that is also because of what they feel like is a deficiency in the roster, whether it's with the forwards that have been out or struggling, or the defensemen that they can't do it.
Let's keep it simple with what we have when Quinn Hughes isn't on the ice.
Perhaps to some extent. So there are wrinkles I think that they can certainly iron out and do a better job of adding to this team as they try to get out of their own zone and through the neutral zone in their transition game, and even some stuff they do in the offensive zone. But it's not a losing formula.
Yeah,
it's a formula that teams are winning with across the NHL now.
It keeps the Canucks in games. They've played, I think, more one-goal games than any team in the NHL this year. They've obviously had a bunch of games go into overtime, more than any other team in the league this year. And while that wasn't the case last year, what was different about last year, especially through the first chunk of the season, they had all of their top stars clicking offensively. And we haven't seen that as much this year. It's been more on the shoulders of Quinn Hughes. But I do think the Canucks are at the forefront of where the game is trending, and that's with, gone are the days of, Carolina still does it to a certain extent, like where you're a volume shooting team. You're wanting to win the Corsi battle. You're wanting to win the shot clock, and that's, you feel as though that is the pathway to winning games. And for a while, yeah, shot attempts and who controlled shot attempts was the best predictor of what was the eventual outcome in National Hockey League games. That's not the case anymore, and we're seeing more and more teams give up decent looks, low-danger chance looks, in favor of looking for that better play, that better opportunity. And in turn, we're going to see a lot more games that have far fewer shots on goal. And I think there's the ugly part of it, the glass half empty part of it, is you're going to see a lot of hockey fans be like, I don't know if I love this, the way that the game is trending and how we're going with this, because you're going to get less chaos.
Yeah, and Kevin and Port Moody nails it. He mentions in 2018, the talk switched from shot volume in previous playoffs to how to create scoring chances and quality over quantity. And in 2018, it was the Washington Capitals. They were the ones who really introduced a lot of extra east-west movement before a shot, and if you looked at their traditional metrics, they weren't great, but they generated a lot of east-west shots, and they scored a ton, and they were a very deadly hockey team, and they did things that teams were not doing as well. And I think that's also the time where, if you look at where the game is today and how it's evolved from 2018 to where we find ourselves today, the metrics, the shot metrics, the publicly available data is not as indicative as it was prior to 2018, because the focus of the game has changed. And what the shot metrics, the public data, does not do a good job of, outside of how they come up with high danger chances, is other layers of scoring chances, how much east-west movement happens, and that every high danger chance isn't equal. And there are certain chances that they don't chart at all or don't give as high dangerous chances, which are high danger chances. So I think it doesn't give the full picture like it used to, or at least closer to the full picture. So I think that's where we get into situations like today with players like Brännström, for instance, right? Mm. If you look at the stats over the total of the season, it's like, well, he's got a lot of good shot metrics. The Canucks defensemen all struggle except for Quinn Hughes. Like, this makes no sense. Why is this guy not playing? But when it comes to the quality of scoring chances against, the high dangers, and the big chances that are given up when he's on the ice, and the breakdowns that are on the ice, they're not being evaluated as well by the public data.
No.
But if you start digging into some of the bigger underlying data, if you get some of the more advanced stuff, you realize the player is a massive defensive liability. Like, the Canucks themselves have talked after games about how their data about scoring chances were pretty good. And if you look at the public data, you're like, well, this makes no sense. It also is true that they cite metrics for their own players. The data they have, I would imagine, tells them more indicatively which players are struggling defensively.
Yeah.
And as much as the public data may show one thing, I don't think these teams are wrong. And I think that there are different ways to interpret what we're seeing now. And I think it is a bit harder by the public data.
Well, and on the odd time that coaches from the Canucks, we heard Adam Foote do it on Saturday when he spoke with Batchin behind the bench during the pregame. And the odd time when Canucks coaches are referencing analytics, it is different what they reference compared to what we see in the public data.
So, for instance, if there's a 2-on-0 and no shot is taken,
yeah,
because the pass missed, it doesn't count as a high danger by the public data.
Yeah.
Because there's no shot attempt, right? Mm-hmm. But that's a 2-on-0. Like, we all know what a scoring chance that was. You may have messed it up, but that was a quality scoring chance.
It may not have ended in a shot or anything like that, but it still should be counted as a scoring chance.
Yeah, for instance, if you make a dangerous seam pass to the back door and the defender checks the stick and he can't tip it in, doesn't count as a shot because a shot never happened, mm-hmm. but that's a high danger chance. You know what I mean? If you're getting a lot of those looks, but they're not being shown by the metrics, then they're not showing a layer of your offense that obviously is dangerous.
So I do think this is something that you should keep an eye on as a hockey fan and where it goes, because the one thing, for as much as analytics has helped evolve sports, one of the issues a lot of professional sports and the four major sports has run into is that there's a danger of a groupthink happening, and then everybody tries to do the same thing.
Yeah, and every league is different. Like Lee says, MLB and NBA, they focused on quantity over quality, but low percentage shots in the NBA and MLB, what is the quantity of hits, for instance, and things like that. But I think as far as three-pointers go, they're the higher point.
Yeah,
points available. So you take more threes. That's what makes sense. Don't take more twos. So it all depends on what to do.
It's what killed the mid-range jumper.
Yeah,
right? Because it's like, well, it might be, you might have a 4% chance, a slightly higher percent chance of making that shot, but it's still more worth it to take the chance that's going to score an extra point.
Yeah, and sports are different. And in hockey, especially with how good goaltenders are now, they can all make the initial save, right? Yeah. And if anything's coming straight on, it's very hard to beat them. And especially with the size and speed of defenders and teams, like, just getting shots through is very difficult.
It's going to be fascinating to see how this continues to develop. But I do think we are starting to see a little bit of that at the top of the league. It's Dan Riccio, Satyar Shah. It is Canuck Central. We'll close out the program with a couple more thoughts on your Canucks and some other things ongoing over the course of the weekend. Mystery solved. Watch all new seasons of your favorite true crime shows on Investigation Discovery. Available on Channel 413 on Rogers Xfinity TV. You are listening to Canuck Central. Final segment here on Canuck Central. Before we get back in on the Canucks, there's just one quick thing I want to say over something that happened on the weekend, Sat.
What happened?
And that is, I think Nick Taylor is the most clutch Canadian athlete right now.
What did you see?
Until
what
Shea Gilgeous-Alexander does... something in the NBA playoffs. I'm gonna say Nick Taylor is the most clutch. He was going on to the 18th hole. He was 400-1 to win the Sony Open this weekend. It's just ridiculous.
And I mean,
400-1, then he nails an eagle chip to force a playoff and wins it in the playoff.
And it was pretty big purse too. How much money did he end up winning?
Like it was over $1.5 million.
Yeah.
He's crazy. Like, you look at all of his wins. You think about the Canadian Open win. He hits a 72-footer. Like, yeah, whatever. Just, like, hits the most insane shot to win every tournament that he's actually won. Won the Waste Management last year. He is a treasure. He is a Canadian treasure. And I don't know what he does on Sundays to lower the heart rate and be able to clutch up for big moments like this, but it is, and I wasn't even watching live, but you see the highlight and it's like, man, this guy is a freak the way that he is able to clutch up in those kinds of moments. Love to see that from Nick Taylor.
I mean, this is like, Nick Taylor has, I guess he's never really been like a highly ranked golfer, right? But how much do you think he's earned in his career from winnings?
Oh, yes. It's I'm going to say close to 20 million.
Yeah. 20,200,000.
Yeah. Man, he's been really good. He's
not bad.
He's not.
He's been on tour since what, like 2015,
yeah.
2016?
I think like he's got 5 tour wins. Like that's a very solid career on the tour. So shout out to Nick Taylor, because the only wins he gets are absolute bangers. Just drains a chip for an eagle on 18. To force a playoff and ends up winning it in the playoff over Echevarria yesterday at the Wailea Country Club in the Sony Open. Shouts to the local boy, Nick Taylor, getting that win yesterday on the tour. So a couple more things on the Canucks. I don't think we need to dive in on Eric Brandstrom any more than we already have.
I mean, listen, I have nothing else to say on Eric Brandstrom. If you want to take up the cause and if you have anything worthwhile to offer to the discourse, go ahead.
It's fine. I think we're good. It was funny to see people around the league like, wow, nobody wants Eric Brandstrom. It's like, yeah, guys.
Well, the thing about...
you don't think the Canucks tried to trade Eric Brandstrom before placing him on waivers this week?
The only reason the Canucks acquired him via trade was because they had to take a contract back in order to dump Tucker Pullman's contract.
Yeah. I mean, Patrick Alvin said it when they brought in Brandstrom. He was asked, like, did you look at Brandstrom in free agency? And he essentially said, yeah, we talked about him, but ultimately... At the time, we didn't think it was a great fit for what we want. This isn't rocket science to figure out why we've ended up here with Eric Brandstrom. And ultimately, like, you might think he's better than some of the other players on the Canucks roster. That's fine for you to think that. The coaching staff doesn't feel like that. And two, there's no way you can make an argument that he was way better than any of those players to a point that he deserves to be on the roster ahead of them. So we are where we are, and people are shocked that Eric Brandstrom not only got on waivers, but he cleared waivers for the second time this year.
The Canucks put him on waivers both times. After the Canucks acquired him, they put him on waivers. Yeah. Anybody could have picked him up. They didn't. Like, okay, let's just...
More importantly, Filip Hronek is back.
Yes, good. That's good news. I like this. A legitimate defenseman.
The Canucks, as we talked about in the open today, briefly, with Hronek coming back, I would hazard a guess. They're not flying Hronek, because he was in Vancouver, obviously was practicing with Abbotsford recently. Chances are the Canucks didn't fly Hronek out to practice with the team in Winnipeg on the final game of a road trip if there wasn't a real good chance of him playing tomorrow against Winnipeg. And by real good chance, I mean the game time decision feels like pretty much a foregone conclusion that Filip Hronek is going to be in the lineup. At least that's my reading of the situation.
So you're saying they did not call him up to Winnipeg to play one game?
Yeah.
To have one practice and one morning skate and then fly back with the team?
Yeah. I feel like it's unlikely, yeah. Sat. I feel like it's unlikely. But, you know.
I mean, the coach said, I'm leaving it up to him.
Yeah.
But, I mean, up to him. He was just practicing with Abbotsford. He came to Winnipeg.
Yeah.
If you leave it up to him, he's playing, most likely.
You know, I could be wrong. You know, Joshua, different situation. But when Joshua was on the mend, he took a while to get practices in before getting back into the lineup. More recently, Pettersson needed a few practices before returning to the lineup for the Vancouver Canucks. So maybe I'm wrong. I don't think I'm wrong on this one. So Hronek's back with the team. And I guess the biggest question is, how do you navigate this if you are the Canucks? Hughes and Myers have played pretty well together, Sat. And I obviously know that if you were to put Hughes and Hronek back together, the results would be better than what the Canucks have gotten out of Hughes and Myers. But I'm not sure it's to a level that... It's not to a level where you have to do it. Because no. Myers and Hughes have actually... They've had some success together here.
I mean, of course, right? And I think the reason why you might feel pretty good about keeping them together is because they've had decent results. They haven't been as good as Hughes and Hronek are together.
Yeah.
But are you getting better ability from the rest of your defense if you put Hronek on a different pair, right? Nolan's asking, what would your D pairs look like? So if you're keeping Hronek and Hughes on separate pairs, I'm assuming you want to keep Hughes with Myers then?
Yeah.
Who do you put with Hronek? It's two options, right? It's either Derek Forbort or Carson Soucy.
So Forbort would be an interesting choice. Would you say Forbort is the one that's playing better right now?
Yes. I mean, Forbort has... I know people. So a lot of people don't like Forbort, but like especially if you look at the last little stretch, he's been one of their better defensemen.
Mm-hmm.
More good things happen than bad when he's on the ice. And he plays really tough minutes and has success. And if you have him together, especially with how he's played... defensively with Filip Hronek, who's a really good puck mover.
Yeah.
Then I kind of want to go with that. Like I think obviously if I'm using these guys in high leverage situations in the playoffs, I'd rather have Soucy with him. But Soucy's game hasn't been consistent enough. And if you look at form currently, Forbort's been better defensively than Soucy has been.
Well, and you know, Myers hasn't really had a ton of success with anybody else that he's played with. We know Soucy Myers has been a problem pair this year for the Canucks.
And Soucy Juulsen, when they're playing as a second pair, I think it's a really high degree of difficulty. Like for all of Juulsen's struggles, and here's the other thing, when people point to Noah Juulsen's metrics and how bad they are, and yeah, I'm not defending Noah Juulsen's game, but he's playing one of the hardest roles on the team.
Yeah.
And actually, he plays one of the harder roles in the NHL, considering the degree of difficulty. Like I've seen his role difficulty be in the 90th percentile.
Like that's very pretty impressive.
Right. And if you look at role difficulty for a guy like Brännström, he's like in the fifth percentile.
Mm-hmm.
One of the easiest deployments in the league so far. So if you look at it, those things are going to play a big part into your numbers as well. There's a reason why he's been playing tougher deployment. But I do think it's better when Juulsen doesn't play that hard a deployment, that hard of opposition consistently. So if you have Soucy and Juulsen playing as a third pair instead, do you get better performances from those two players?
I think this is the reason you explore this idea of Hronek and Hughes on separate pairs for, you know, parts of the game. Sure, you could change it up depending on game state and all of this. But again, Hughes and Myers have been really good together. 15 goals for, just 8 against in 285 minutes played. So now if you can keep that and maybe get another pair, because the other thing, when you look at other D pairs that the Canucks have put together this year, so Hughes Hronek have been on the ice for 18 goals at 5-on-5. Hughes Myers have been on the ice for 15 goals at 5-on-5. No other D pair that the Canucks have iced this season has scored more than seven, has seen the Canucks score more than 7 goals while they've been on the ice. That's a pretty big drop off. And it really, it again speaks to how this team can't really generate offense without Hughes on the ice. So that's why, you know, I really do want to see if Hronek can be able to push a little bit more offense when the Canucks are in minutes without Hughes on the ice.
Yeah, and we know what he can do with Hughes, like you said, from that standpoint. But without Hughes, how much can he do? But the fact that you're playing a guy $7.25 million, you would hope he is able to at least move the puck well, you know, down the lineup, so to speak, right? Being on the second pair, which is not really that far down the lineup. And I think we have to explore these things a little bit and see what it looks like so we know truly what the Canucks have to acquire here at the deadline, right? Like, if you're keeping Hughes and Hronek together, you kind of need a right-hand defenseman.
Yeah.
That kind of becomes your big thing of need, big area of need. But if he can play the right, if they're playing on separate pairs, not that you don't need another righty, you obviously would like to have one, but the pressure's not as high, then could you put your focus on finding a lefty that's really good? So you're upgrading a Susie and forward, and then you can slide one of those guys to the third pair right side. I know they don't love that, but we saw it last year with Zadorov. Like, they're not against doing it if the players are of higher quality. We saw with Cole, Zadorov, Susie types, right? And I think that could be a determining factor here, depending on how you want to keep these guys or how you want to deploy these two players.
Well, like, let's just think about, and hey, don't know if Ivan Provorov is going to get traded, but he is the biggest rental name on defense right now. If you were to acquire Ivan Provorov, it's a left shot D. Your second pair could be Provorov, Hronek, and you keep Hughes, Myers together. Now we're talking, right? Like, now you might have two real legitimate pairs that you can throw out onto the ice for, I don't know, close to 50 minutes a game. That's something I think you would really have to look at if you are the Vancouver Canucks. So it could open up other options. I think that's another reason why I'd like to at least explore what it looks like, considering Hughes and Myers have had a pretty good amount of success in their minutes together with Hronek out of the lineup.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how it goes. Honestly, I'm excited to see Hronek come back to the lineup, to see a bit higher quality from the Canucks blue line. Can they explore different things? It feels like we have different things to try now, finally. Like, a lot of what we've seen from the Canucks in the first half of the season was, how do you keep things together with spit and glue? And now it's like, okay, like, the only guy missing is Dakota Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
And you are going to have injuries, but at least you have your two best defensemen. You have your two best centers.
Yeah.
You have your best wingers.
Mm-hmm.
You have your best goalies. They're all healthy now. And now we can finally explore what it might look like when you have your best players playing together and in what situation you put them in. And I'm hoping, dude, that they turn the corner here and start winning some games and really change the discourse in a positive way.
A couple of texts coming in before we go. Basketball Phil, glad you shouted out SGA there, Dan. Currently tied for the scoring lead in the association. SGA is having a good year, and I'm pretty sure most players in the NBA think he is the rightful MVP this year.
He's incredible, man. Like, honestly, he's must watch. If you're not a basketball fan, but you care about Canadian athletes, take the time to watch Shai Gilgeous-Alexander play basketball. Like, he's an absolute artist. He's a killer, and I really like OKC's team.
Yeah,
I know that a lot of Sonics fans here don't like OKC, and trust me, I've had a lot of harsh words for the Thunder over the years, and how they messed up the big three when they had Harden and Westbrook and Durant all together and didn't do anything with it and all that. But their team is formidable, man.
Yeah,
like, and if he ends up winning a title, wins an MVP, like, we're talking about a guy who's going to put himself into, like, not the all time great, but he's going to be one of those players where he could have a Hall of Fame career.
Yeah.
And might end up being a better, more impactful player in the NBA than Steve Nash was. And
which
Steve
is
Nash
crazy.
Is a two-time NBA MVP winner, right? But this is what the potential that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has.
A couple of Canadian athletes we shouted out there to keep an eye on outside of hockey. Before we go, a couple more texts. Lee talking about Hronek in Winnipeg, maybe to not even play. Lee says, you don't go to Winnipeg for its rich tourism. Personally, I've never done that.
I don't know. I mean, listen, I think when it comes to cities like Winnipeg and even Edmonton, they get a lot of flack, but they can be a lot of fun cities to go to. There's a lot of good spots to go to. Yeah. The people are fun.
I heard the Earls in Winnipeg is a good spot.
Yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
I'll take it under advisement.
It's where the players frequent after a game. Boys, you can't rule out the possibility of slipping on a patch of ice in Winnipeg on the way to the game day skate. Isn't that why they have the underground tunnels or something?
But I mean, facts only, things can happen.
Things can happen.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
But hopefully not.
None of that will happen to any of the Vancouver Canucks ahead of tomorrow's game in the Peg. Stan Riccio, Satyar Shah. Shouts to producers Costa and Elon today. And I guess producer Josh Elliott Wolf, who's sweating out his Minnesota Vikings right now.
Yeah, I'm only keeping one eye on the game because, you know, we're working here, right? But I think Josh Elliott Wolf may have poisoned Bic Nizar. So he got sick today. So he stepped in for Bic so he could be off in time. Now, because of those shenanigans, he won't be rewarded for the victory maybe. So we'll see what happens.
Well, wouldn't be the craziest thing to happen to the Vikings, that's for sure. It's Canucks Central. We'll talk to you tomorrow at 3 o'clock ahead of Canucks and Winnipeg on Sportsnet 650.